The Blue Island experiences of a new arrival, Beyond the Veil. Communicated by W. T. Stead and Arthur Conan Doyle, London 1922. A letter from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Dear Miss Stead, I found the narrative most interesting and helpful. I have no means of judging the exact conditions under which it was produced, or now far subconscious influences may have been at work, but on the surface of it, speaking as a literary critic, I should say that the clear expression and the happy knack of smiles were very characteristic of your father. We have to face the difficulty that the details of these numerous descriptions of next spheres differ in various manuscripts, but, on the other hand, no one can deny that the resemblances far exceed the differences. We have to remember that the next world is infinitely complex and subdivided. My father's house has many mansions, and that, even in this small world, the accounts of two witnesses would never be the same. If a description were given by an Oxford Don, and also by an Indian peasant, 11 their respective stories of life in this world would vary much more than any two accounts that I have ever read of the world to come. I have specialized in that direction. The physical phenomena never interested me much, and I can hardly think that anyone has read more accounts, printed, typed and written, than I have done, many of them from people who had no idea what the ordinary spiritualist scheme of things might be. In some cases the mediums were children. Always there emerges the same idea of a world like ours, a world where all our latent capabilities and all our hidden ambitions have free and untrammeled opportunities. In all there is the same talk of solid ground, of familiar flowers and animals, of congenial occupations, all very different to the vague and uncomfortable heaven of the churches. I confess that I cannot trace in any of these any allusion to a place exactly corresponding to the Blue Island, though the color blue is, of course, that of healing, and an island may be only an isolated sphere, the antechamber to others. I believe that such material details as sleep, nourishment, etc., depend upon the exact position of the soul in its evolution. The lower the soul, the more material the conditions. It is of enormous importance that the human race should know these things, for it not only takes away all fears of death, but it must, as in the case of your father, be of the very greatest help when one is suddenly called to the other side, and finds oneself at once in known surroundings, sure of one's future, instead of that most unpleasant period of readjustment during which souls have to unlearn what their teachers here have taught and adapt themselves to unfamiliar facts. Good luck to your little book. A. Conan Doyle. Crowborough, Sussex, England. September 1922. Preface. When in April 1912 the Titanic sank in mid-ocean and my father passed on to the next world, I was on tour with my own Shakespearean company. Amongst the members of that company was a young man named Pardo Wigman, who on the very Sunday of the disaster foretold it as we sat talking after tea. He did not name the boat or my father, but he got so much that pointed to disaster at sea and the passing on of an elderly man intimately connected with me, that when the sad news came through we realized he must have been closely in touch with what was about to happen. I mention this incident because it formed the first link between my father and Mr. Woodman, and as it is largely due to Mr. Woodman's psychic powers that my father has been able to get through the messages which are contained in this book, I think, therefore, it will be of interest to readers and should be put on record. A fortnight after the disaster I saw my father's face and heard his voice just as distinctly as I heard it when he bade me goodbye before embarking on the Titanic. This was at a sitting with Etterette, the well-known American direct voice medium. At this sitting, I talked with my father for over 20 minutes. This may seem an amazing assertion to many, but it is a fact vouched for by all those who were present at the sitting. I put it on record at the time in an article published in Nash's magazine, which included the signed testimonies of all those present. From that day to this I have been in constant touch with my father. I have had many talks with him and communications from him containing very definite proof of his continued presence amongst us. I can truly say that the link between us is even stronger today than in 1912, when he threw off his physical body and passed on to the spirit world. There has never been a feeling of parting, Although at first the absence of his physical presence was naturally a source of very great sadness. In 1917, Mr. Woodman was invalided out of the army and came to stay with us at our country cottage at Cobham. Whilst with us, the news came to him that his great friend had been killed at the front, and his interest in the possibility of communication with the next world, which had been indifferent till then, became intense, and he set out to find out for himself. It is ever the passing of a loved one that gives the necessary stimulus for eager inquiry. It was not long before his friend was able to give him definite proofs of his continued existence and of his ability to communicate. His first proofs were given through Wout Peters, and were given through Wout Peters, and were followed by others through Gladys Osborne Leonard's mediumship and through the mediumship of friends gifted with psychic powers. I was present at that first sitting with Mr. Peters. Father was there also, and his friend said it was due to my father's presence and help that he was able to succeed so well in these first attempts at communication. Shortly after this, Mr. Woodman found that he himself had the power of automatic writing, and father and others were soon able to write through him. Father always prefers me to be present, as if I am not he seems to have more difficulty, and very rarely will attempt writing. He explains the necessity of my presence in this way, he and I are so much en rapport, and so closely in touch with each other, that he is able to draw much power from me. I act as the connecting link and form a sort of battery between him and Mr. Woodman. I merely sit passively by whilst Mr. Woodman writes. Certainly I see a light around us, and a strong ray of light concentrating on Mr. Woodman's arm. Sometimes I am able to see Father himself, and always, when he is writing, I feel his presence very distinctly. We have received many messages in this way. For a while in 1918 we sat regularly every week, and were kept in touch with much that was going on at the front and about what was about to happen, and were advised of occurrences often days before the news came through in the ordinary way. In one case Father gave us the actual headlines which would, and did, appear in the papers the following week. It is interesting also of importance to note that Mr. Woodman and my father met only once before the passing of latter. I introduced Mr. Woodman to him not long before he left England in the Titanic, and they only exchanged two or three words. Therefore, Mr. Woodman never knew my father personally nor was he come into touch with his writings or with his work in any way. And yet the wording and the phrasing of the messages are my father's, and even the manner of writing is typical of him. Mr. Woodman also writes with his eyes closed, and often holds a handkerchief over them. Some of the best messages were given in the twilight when it was impossible for me to follow what was being written, and yet the words were never overwritten. The writing will stop sometimes whilst father evidently reads over what has been written, and alterations will be made. I's dotted and T's crossed correctly. It was a habit of my father's, whilst here, to go back over his copy and cross his T's and dot his I's. This habit was only known to a few, and was certainly absolutely unknown to Mr. Woodman. Two of the messages obtained in this way have already been published. They were given by my father for Armistice Day, 1920, and Armistice Day, 1921. For the first, we had no idea he contemplated giving a message. A few friends, including Mr. Woodman, were taking tea with my mother and myself on the Sunday before the 11th of November. We had been chatting on various subjects, when I suddenly felt my father come into the room and could tell by the feeling he gave me that he wished us to give him an opportunity to write, and that it was urgent. It was impossible to arrange for that evening, so we made an appointment for the evening following. Mr. Woodman came about 9 o'clock. We sat chatting by the fire for a few minutes, then we felt Father come in, and we sat at once. Father's manner was exactly as it used to be when here in the body and he wanted to get something important done. He must concentrate on that and on nothing else. Directly we sat, Mr. Woodman's hand began to move, and Father wrote words to this effect: I have my message ready. And if you do not interrupt, I hope to succeed in getting it through. He wrote at tremendous speed, and in about half an hour had given his message. Having finished, he gave directions that it should be read through and punctuated, if necessary. then left us, not a word about anything else. It was a strenuous half hour for us all, but it was worth it. The message was printed the next day and many thousands distributed to those visiting the cenotaph that year. The 1921 message was given in the same manner, and thousands of copies of the two messages, now printed in pamphlet form, were distributed on Armistice Day, 1921. It was soon after giving this last message that Father expressed the wish that we should sit for the messages given in this book. We had felt for some time that he was wanting us to sit for a series of messages, but asked that if this was so he would give us definite instructions to this effect from an outside source. This he did by asking Mrs. Gail A. Bamba, the author of Claude's books, at a sitting which she was having with Mrs. Leonard, to tell us that it was quite true he did wish us to sit for a series of messages which, he said, would tell of his arrival and some of his experiences on the other side. Both Mr. Woodman and I are busy people, and can only give what spare time we have from our ordinary work to psychic matters, so that it was difficult to fit in times, therefore it was a few months before we had finished taking the messages. These were all given in the manner already described. They were consecutively, but definite instructions were not given as to how the whole series was to be arranged. Father's foreword explains his object in writing this book, so there is no need to dwell on that here. When he started, he had a rather longer book in view, but decided in favor of a short book, as it is more likely to be read, can be published at a reasonable price, and so stand the chance of reaching more people. All who worked with my father here will know that such reasoning was characteristic of him. The photograph given as frontispiece to this volume was taken by the Crewe Circle at Crewe in the autumn of 1915. In the spring of that year, I had met Mr. Hope and Mrs. Buxton at the house of a mutual friend in Glasgow, and they very kindly invited me to call and see them in Crewe if I should ever have an opportunity to do so. Soon after my return to London, Father asked me to arrange to go to Crewe, as he said he wanted to try to give us his picture on the same plate with mine. Accordingly, I arranged to spend a weekend with some friends at Crewe and have some sittings with Mr. Hope and Mrs. Buxton. I bought a box of plates in London and took them with me, and I can truthfully say that that box of plates never left my sight or my possession all the time I was there. I even slept with the box clasped tightly in my hands. We had our first sitting on the Saturday, when I obtained two extras, neither resembling my father. One was of interest because it was the picture of a lady who had appeared on the plate with my father when he was experimenting with Mr. Bursnell in the 90s. I took my box containing the rest of the plates away with me after the sitting, bought another box of plates in Crewe, and took both boxes with me to the sitting on the Sunday. We did not use my first box at all at this sitting, and I kept it all the while just inside my dress. We sat around the table, putting our hands over and under the second box for a few minutes. I then held the box for a minute against Mrs. Buxton's forehead. After this I was instructed by Mr. Hope's guide to take the box myself into the dark room. Note: the box had not been unsealed or the plates exposed to the light. When in the dark room, I was to unseal the box and take out the two bottom plates, taking particular care to note which was the bottom plate, and then to develop both plates. Mr. Hope was to come in with me, but not to touch box or plates. I carried out instructions. I found the bottom plate not even fogged, and on the other plate two messages, one from Archdeacon Kelly, deploring Father's inability to write, one from Mr. Walker, the father of my host, and in one corner of the plate a faint outline of my father's face. When I got back to my friends that evening, we had a sitting at which Father expressed his keen disappointment at his failure to give his picture. "It is all my fault," he said. "I am so excited at the idea of getting my picture beside yours after I have been so called dead for so many years that I break the conditions. However, many have promised to help me tomorrow, and if I fail again we have something else prepared to slip on so that you will not be quite so disappointed." On the following morning I went for my last sitting. Two of my own plates were used. On both of these are pictures of my father. One is reproduced in this book, the other is a large face of Father which completely covers me. Now, having, I hope, given a little idea as to how these messages were obtained, and our reasons for feeling that they do indeed come from my father, I am content to let the Blue Island do the rest. I am sure it will interest many, and if it awakens some to a truer realization of what is to come, and makes them seek for further definite proofs themselves, then the three chiefly concerned in giving these messages to the public, my father, Mr. Woodman and myself, will be amply satisfied. Estelle W. Stead. September 1922, A Foreword from the Spirit World. By William T. Stead. There is great trepidation on the part of all the uninitiated when first coming into contact with the occult, psychic or unknown forces. In many of life's mysteries there is much pleasure to be had in probing the secret, and the mystery is in itself an incentive to search and to inquire, to overcome the unknown and to gain knowledge on subjects not previously known or proven. This, however, does not seem to apply when dealing with the mysteries surrounding the afterlife. There is always a fear of something, frequently personal, but sometimes fear of harming the individual known and loved on earth. In itself that is a good sign, it argues unselfishness, and consequently the individual who holds off for that reason deserves enlightenment. If he is sufficiently advanced to seek, he will get enlightenment together with great help. Again, there are those who, imbued with theosophical ideas, fear to come in contact with what is to their minds the shell of a former loved one, and those who fear through ignorance due to an undeveloped and somewhat uneducated mentality. By that I do not necessarily mean an unschooled mentality. I speak of uneducated in the sense of lacking understanding and appreciation of the higher things of life. To all these people I am, and I always was, most sympathetic. In earth life I did my best to help and enlighten, but I was very restricted owing to material calls upon my time. Since my arrival in this land I have tried to carry on and greatly to increase the amount and the sphere of this same work. I have succeeded up to a point, though many have not yet reached the halfway step on that staircase of knowledge leading to understanding. I was on the point of saying leading to happiness, but that would not be quite correct, for happiness is most amply contained in understanding, and happiness in the sense that it is used and understood on earth is not the raison d'etre of life. We were not made only to be happy. Happiness is part of our reward for work done, for progress and for help given to others, which is itself the outcome of understanding. As I have said, in my work on this side of the borderland I have achieved a certain success, and I am confident that if I can pass on the knowledge I have gained, together with my own personal experiences, to you who are still on earth, I shall have gone a little farther in the work to which I have set my hand for the good of humanity. What I have to tell will be of interest to many, and will be useless to many more, but I am going to tell of things which each one of my readers can, up to a point, test for himself. You can each one of you test it by soul knowledge, and by that you will know that I am giving you words of value, words which God in His infinite love has permitted me to be the means of passing to you. It is not my idea of the mysteries of life, it is a discourse on those mysteries. There is the teaching of Christianity running all through, but the application is different to that ordinarily accepted. It is quite erroneous to suppose that because a man was a man on earth, he will become a spirit angled the moment he dies. Death is only the doorway from one room to another, and both rooms are very similarly furnished and arranged. That's what I want you to appreciate thoroughly, it is under the same guiding hand. The same personality rules all spheres. Beginning at the beginning, I have to tell you how a man finds himself here on arrival. As I have said, this whole book will interest many and help a few. It is for that few that all concerned are making the necessary effort to bring it to them. It does not attempt or pretend to be on scientific lines. All through, you can apply sound common sense, and you cannot break down what is. I have dealt with the subject very briefly, only for the reason that many will read a short, concise account who would not study a detailed one. I must impress upon you all, the interested and the disinterested, the believer in this great subject, spiritualism, and the skeptic, to remember you are still on earth and you have still to perform earth's duties. You have your daily lives to lead and you must always do well the work in hand. Never neglect the present because the future appears more brightly colored. Carry on with today, but with a corner of your mind on tomorrow, and remember also that phenomenal spiritualism is not for all. Many minds could not absorb the greatness of the subject together with the facts of the phenomena and still continue in their routine in normal manner. These are the people for whom phenomena spiritualism is not. They will be wise to go no further into the subject than knowledge gained from books and from the experiences of others. In this sense, spiritualism is not for all. William T. Stead. Chapter 1. The Arrival. The Blue Island. Communicated by W. D. Stead, through the hand of Estelle Stead. Experience of a New Arrival Beyond the Veil. Chapter 1. Many years ago I was attracted by an article on the subject of spirit communication, and, after reading it carefully several times, I was forced to admit its soundness. I was struck by the plain and practical ideas of the writer. This was the first cause of my becoming actively interested in this big and amazing work. From that time onward I did all in my power to prove and then forward the movement. Many people know this, and those who do not, can become acquainted with the details if they wish. Therefore I am going to pass at once from my first earth interest in the occult to my first interest in the earth. Just as I was overcome with astonishment and satisfaction on first reaching conviction on earth, so I was astonished almost equally on my coming to this land and finding that my knowledge of this subject gained on earth was strikingly correct in nearly all the chief points. There was a great satisfaction in proving this. I was at once amazed and delighted to find so much truth in all I had learned, for although I had believed implicitly, I was not entirely without grave misgivings upon many minor details. Hence my general satisfaction when I recognized things and features which, though I had accepted whilst on earth, I had scarcely anticipated would be as I now found them. This must sound somewhat contradictory, but I want you to understand that my earthly misgivings were based on fear that perhaps the spirit world had a formula of its own which was quite different from our earthly mentality, and that, therefore, the many points were transmitted to us in such a form and in such expression as we on earth would be able to grasp and appreciate, and were not in themselves the precise descriptions, owing to the limitations of earth word expression. Of my actual passing from earth to spirit life, I do not wish to write more than a few lines. I have already spoken of it several times and in several places. The first part of it was naturally an extremely discordant one, but from the time my physical life was ended there was no longer that sense of struggling with overwhelming odds, but I do not wish to speak of that. My first surprise came when, I now understand that to your way of thinking I was dead, I found I was in a position to help people. From being in dire straits myself, to being able to lend a hand to others, was such a sudden transition that I was frankly and blankly surprised. I was so taken aback that I did not consider the why and the wherefore at all. I was suddenly able to help. I knew not how or why and did not attempt to inquire. There was no analysis then, that came a little later. I was also surprised to find a number of friends with me, people I knew had passed over years before. That was the first cause of my realizing the change had taken place. I knew it suddenly and was a trifle alarmed. Practically instantaneously I found myself looking for myself. Just a moment of agitation, momentary only, and then the full and glorious realization that all I had learned was true. Oh, how badly I needed a telephone at that moment. I felt I could give the papers some headlines for the evening. That was my first realization. Then came a helplessness, a reaction, a thought of all my own at home. They didn't know yet. What would they think of me? Here was I, with my telephone out of working order for the present. I was still so near to the earth that I could see everything going on there. Where I was, I could see the wrecked ship, the people, the whole scene, and that seemed to pull me into action. I could help. And so in a few seconds, though I am now taking a long time to tell you, it was only a few seconds really, I found myself changed from the helpless state to one of action, helpful not helpless, was helpful, too, I think. I pass a little now. The end came and it was all finished with. It was like waiting for a liner to sail. We waited until all were aboard. I mean we waited until the disaster was complete. The saved, saved, the dead, alive. Then in one hole we moved our scene. It was a strange method of traveling for us all, and we were a strange crew, bound for we knew not where. The whole scene was indescribably pathetic. Many, knowing what had occurred, were in agony of doubt as to their people left behind and as to their own future state. What would it hold for them? Would they be taken to see him? What would their sentence be? Others were almost mental wrecks. They knew nothing, they seemed to be uninterested in everything, their minds were paralyzed. A strange crew indeed, of human souls waiting their ratings in the new land. A matter of a few minutes in time only, and here were hundreds of bodies floating in the water, dead, hundreds of souls carried through the air, alive, very much alive, some were. Many, realizing their death had come, were enraged at their own powerlessness to save their valuables. They fought to save what they had on earth prized so much. The scene on the boat at the time of the striking was not so pleasant, but it was as nothing to the scene among the poor souls newly thrust out of their bodies, all unwillingly. It was both heartbreaking and repellent. And thus we waited, waited until all were collected, until all were ready, and then we moved our scene to a different land. It was a curious journey that. Far more strange than anything I had anticipated. We seemed to rise vertically into the air at terrific speed. As a whole we moved, as if we were on a very large platform, and this was hurled into the air with gigantic strength and speed, yet there was no feeling of insecurity. We were quite steady. I cannot tell how long our journey lasted, nor how far from the earth we were when we arrived, but it was a gloriously beautiful arrival. It was like walking from your own Indian sky. There, all was brightness and beauty. We saw this land far off when we were approaching, and those of us who could understand realized that we were being taken to the place destined for all those people who pass over suddenly, on account of its general appeal. It helps the nerve-wracked newcomer to fall into line and regain mental balance very quickly. We arrived feeling, in a sense, proud of ourselves. It was all lightness, brightness. Everything as physical and quite as material in every way as the world we had just finished with. Our arrival was greeted with welcomes from many old friends and relations who had been dear to each one of us in our earth life. And having arrived, we people who had come over from that ill-fated ship parted company. We were free agents again, though each one of us was in the company of some personal friends who had been over here a long while. Chapter 2 The Blue Island. Chapter 2. I have told you a little about the journey and arrival, and I want now to tell you my first impression and a few experiences. I must begin by saying I do not know how long after the collision these experiences took place. It seemed to be a continuation without any break, but I cannot be certain that this was so. I found myself in company with two old friends, one of them my father. He came to be with me, to help and generally show me round. It was like nothing else so much as merely arriving in a foreign country and having a chum to go around with. That was the principal sensation. The scene from which we had so lately come was already well relegated to the past. Having accepted the change of death, all the horror of our late experience had gone. It might have been 50 years ago instead of, perhaps, only last night. Consequently, our pleasure in the new land was 45, not marred by grief at being parted from earth friends. I will not say that none were unhappy, many were. But that was because they did not understand the nearness of the two worlds, they did not know what was possible. But to those who understood the possibilities, it was in a sense the feeling, let us enjoy a little of this new land before mailing our news home. Therefore there was little grief in our arrival. In writing my first experiences I am going to give a certain amount of detail. My old sense of humor is still with me, I am glad to say, and I know that what I have to say now will cause a certain amount of amusement to those who treat this subject lightly, but that I do not mind. I am glad they will find something to smile at, it will make an impression on them that way, and then when their own time comes for the change they will recognize themselves amongst the conditions of which I am going to write. Therefore to that kind of skeptic I just say, it's all right, friend, and, you give no offense. My father and I, with my friend also, set out immediately. A curious thing struck me. I was clothed exactly as I had been, and it seemed a little strange to me to think I had brought my clothing with me. There's number one, Mr. Skeptic.